Now, for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. And in the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent, and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all of you were as I am. But each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest I say this, and again, I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or the sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife?
Good morning, everyone. I can feel the waves of sympathy already ebbing through to me at present. Which is lovely. So I'm sure you all know that it was Valentine's Day this week. And being the amazing husband I am, I did make sure some very nice flowers were delivered on the day, which Jen was very pleased with, and I'm not going to get shouted at again, which is fantastic. And then things get a little bit strange, because the flowers arrive, and Jen is at home with Joe, who's my little four-year-old boy. So Jen explains that Daddy has bought these flowers because it's Valentine's Day. And somehow Joe gets into his head that I bought them also kind of for him. And he was very pleased about this, and he kept saying, how did Daddy know roses were my favourite? And Valentine's Day is my favourite day of the year. He then takes things up a notch when he realises that Daddy has bought him his wonderful flowers and Mummy hasn't got him anything. Which she now needs to, because it's Valentine's Day and she loves him too, right? Goodness knows what I'll have to get him next year, although at least now I know that roses are his favourites. So that was a real bright spot and left me chuckling for days afterwards, which was helpful because sermon preparation week has been tricky even by my standards. When you're given a subject to preach on as part of a series, you don't necessarily take a good look until the Sunday before, because at that point, somebody is preaching on the part before yours, and it's basically an ideal way to be introduced to what you're going to be speaking about. Normally, when it's worked out this way, when I'm listening on the Sunday, it's very easy to be really engaged, to tune in, and I've come out with a few good ideas about how I'm going to handle things. It's generally very helpful. However, I'm not sure I can say the same about last week. Because when Mark started preaching and I started to pick up on the parts of the Bible he was going through, I was initially a little nervous. Mark, I'm not sure you read the passage out beforehand. Is that right? In its entirety before? You can't remember either. Well, as you went through your talk, I started to realise why that might be the case. And a little way into the talk, I thought, I think I better look at the next chapter and look at the part I'm actually going to be speaking on here. And I think it's fair to say my slight nervousness moved on to worry and on towards complete and utter panic. The thought of preaching on, in part, sexual intimacy within relationships is almost the last thing I would want to be bringing a message to you on. And as I look around the room, that feeling is returning. And if anything, it's more acute than ever. This is a subject I would definitely refer to as being in the category of kind of dodgy ground, because it's very personal. It's quite a tough read, as it goes into a lot of specifics about personal relationships. And I'm very aware that I don't know a lot about your personal situations. And please don't take that as an invite to tell me your deepest, darkest secrets, unless, you know, they're really interesting. I just don't want to be insensitive to those personal situations. But at the same time, this is what I've been asked to speak on, so I can't really step away from that. This is happening. So, thinking of ways to cope with this, I could just speak as fast as possible. And I've already had two people mention to me today that sometimes I do that anyway, so that might work. And maybe one way of just getting things over with. But what I've gone for instead, the way we're going to get through this, is if I regularly tell a few little jokes just to ease the tension and hopefully stop things from getting really uncomfortable all around. I can see you're already very intrigued as to how this is going to go. So this is a coping strategy for me. You may find it helpful or unhelpful. If you find it helpful, fantastic. And if you don't, well, at least I warned you. Right, this is your first one. A little girl and a little boy were at preschool one day. And the girl goes up to the boy and says, "Hey, do you want to play mummies and daddies?" And he said, "Sure, okay. What do you need me to do?" So the girl says, "I want you to communicate your feelings." "Communicate my feelings," says the boy. "I have no idea what that means." The little girl nods and says, "I guess you're going to be the daddy then." You know, have a general idea of the standard we're talking about here. So, getting into the passage, there is some really great stuff in here. But if it's anything, it's a lesson in why getting just a reply to a letter, which the book of 1 Corinthians is, and if anything, it's actually more than that. It's communication in the midst of an established relationship between Paul and the church, which has history and shared experience and feelings between the participants, none of which we can adequately fill in here. And all of us lead us to not being able to get it in the way that we would otherwise. And what this passage also is a lesson in why context, when you read the Bible, is absolutely the number one thing if you want to have correct understanding and not find yourself completely misled. Again, Mark in his talk last week set the scene really well in reminding us about what the city of Corinth was like. My own attempt at an analogy would be that it made Las Vegas look like Bexhill-on-Sea. Which, if you think sounds good, I would advise you to get prayer afterwards. So quickly, through the facts for those who weren't here or who, like me, have the memory of a goldfish. We're in Corinth, and Corinth is a city in Greece. And now, the Greeks at this time had a whole host of gods that they worshipped, which basically seems to constitute one of the earliest soap operas ever. You have messy relationships between the gods, family conflict, you have murder, jealousy, intrigue, unrequited love and lust, you name it. This wasn't the people, this was the gods that people looked up to, they revered and worshipped. So how bad must the people who worship gods like that be? And now the goddess Aphrodite was especially worshipped in Corinth, and she had a major temple there. And as the goddess of a slightly odd mix of love, beauty, pleasure, and procreation, that definitely reflected in Corinth with one of the busiest industries of a certain type in the entire ancient world. And her importance would have had a huge impact on all the people who chose to live and work in a city like that, whether they were directly involved in that industry or not. And so, into that mix, into a city like this, one or two people come, maybe a handful of people, come to the city of Corinth to preach the good news, telling people about Jesus. And people actually start to respond, and a church springs up in a city like that. That is going to cause some issues. I mean, what would it be like having grown up in a place like that and accepting all of those things, all of those behaviours as normal? How do you get your head around not only the change that's happened in you, but the fact that this place that you considered to be normal, that you live in, hasn't changed at all? And all of a sudden, you have a real problem with that. You have a problem with what is going on around you. But as a relatively new believer, you don't necessarily have the tools to know how to start dealing with that. That is what Paul is writing into here. These are the people that he is writing to. And he's actually writing in response to some specific questions he's been asked. He starts in verse 1 by answering a question. What he says is, "Now, for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife, and each woman with her own husband." So, what we have here is the Corinthian church's response to being a believer in their city. Their suggestion to Paul is it better for a person, any person, just to be celibate? They're looking at the kind of lives that they've left behind, or trying to leave behind, looking at the mess around them, and weighing all of that up, they think, what if it's just better just not to? What if sex is the problem? This is a knee-jerk reaction from some people within the church who want to demonstrate that they're different, that they have changed. So they essentially ask Paul, is there something inherently wrong with the act itself that should lead us to just set ourselves apart from that permanently? That's the question that they've asked him. And what Paul immediately picks up on here is that they've missed the real issue here entirely, because the real issue is in the head. It's temptation. And if anything, abstinence is likely to cause more issues than it solves by stifling the natural desires and giving them the opportunity to take root as something other than that, potentially something darker than that. And it's such a completely and utterly wrong idea that I actually feel quite sad for the people who felt that that was a good suggestion to make to deal with the problem. But Paul, who knows the individuals who make up the church in Corinth, who knows them personally, he takes the opportunity to point them in the right direction by affirming the marriage relationship as the right and natural place for those desires to be outworked. And what we also have mentioned here is the equality, where both parties are essentially to yield to each other, not the husband over the wife, nor the wife over the husband, but both equally to the other. Speaking of equality in marriage, in the waiting room of heaven, there were two queues of men waiting to be allowed entry through the pearly gates. And one of the queues had a sign which said, "Men who were bossed around by their wives." And the other one said, "Men who weren't bossed around by their wives." Now, obviously, there was a rather large queue for the first one. That's not a joke. But then the angel who was checking names in the Book of Life saw one man in the other line. So he told the guys in his queue to wait, and he went over and asked the man why he was in that line. And the man looked around nervously and said, "I don't know. My wife told me to stand here." Fortunately, the biblical view of marriage written about here is far more equal than that. In verse 4 we read, "The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife." So there's perfect symmetry of one person allowing someone else to be more important than them. Easy to say, possibly one of the most difficult things to practice. And a principle that's meant to apply throughout the relationship, not just in this one area. And the reason behind all of this, we read, is that if you try to control these things, you try to control these desires with your willpower, it just leads people into a position where they just get tempted. And far from resolving the issue that the Corinthians were trying to fix, if followed, these actions would actually put them in a very vulnerable position and far more likely to be drawn back into the kind of lifestyles that they were trying to leave behind. Paul doesn't want them to be exposed to excessive temptation. Two particular areas that the devil wants to attack in a marriage are physical intimacy and spiritual intimacy, our prayer lives. Now, both are mentioned together in this passage, and it's certainly no coincidence. Paul puts the spotlight on both, and he actually elevates prayer above physical intimacy by saying a specific time-limited devotion to prayer would be the only valid reason to abstain. And the reasons those in Corinth were suggesting it for were not only not necessary, they were not healthy. And so we can move on to the next section where we start in verse 7, where Paul says, I wish that all of you were as I am, but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. A wise man once said, I never knew what real happiness was until I got married, but by then it was too late. Rob didn't write all of these jokes, by the way. It might seem at this point as if he did. He would be a good script writer for this kind of thing. Yeah, no, I'll get in touch for next time. You can let me know his rates. Singleness can be, I think it's fair to say, quite an unappreciated status at times. Certainly not something that people would immediately recognise as being a gift. But Paul takes that idea and he turns it on its head in this part of the passage where he says, I wish you could be like me. Essentially, he's saying, fully free to devote yourselves to the gospel in the way that I am. And it's an issue I did consider at points in my own life. I really haven't had a girlfriend of any description in my teens. While by the time Ed was 16, he'd had at least 40 girlfriends. Which just goes to show there really is no accounting for taste. Sorry. Okay, yeah, no, that's fine. I lost count. And then increasingly through my 20s, I did start to wonder, I say wonder, I think I mean worry, that being single might be a gift that God might have been looking to impart to me, of which I would have been a very unwilling recipient. And what kept me going during those times is that I really wasn't content being single. So it made no logical sense and didn't really fit with what I understood about God or being single for him in particular. Because the individuals that I've known, who I believe would recognize that they have been called to that life, I would say that their commitment to God is amazing. And it has always impressed me how he so obviously used them in ways that he wouldn't have been able to under any other circumstance. When God calls people to singleness, he blesses them and he provides for that person all that they need. Now, reading between the lines, what I think really comes through in this little bit is that every different type of status, whether single or married, widowed, each of these can be a gift. Each of us has our own. All of us are different, and therefore God and can use us in very different ways as that status allows. And then we come to the really tricky part of the passage. This is a really tough subject, again, which I know all too well from personal experience. Marriage is tough. I mean, I haven't even spoken to my wife for the last 18 months. It's not that I don't like her. I just don't like to interrupt her. It's going to be a lot more fun in the second service when Jen's here, isn't it? I've only ever had one walkout before, so no, it's going to be good. I only have one viewpoint. This is the difficulty. Okay, we can talk about this afterwards, Francis. Heckled as well, goodness me. So verse 10. To the married I give this command, not I but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband, But if she does, she must remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. A command that comes from the Lord, says Paul, saying that neither partner should seek to separate themselves from the other. And if either does, they must either stay alone or be reconciled. Now, I'm going to appear to be very controversial here and say that what Paul writes here is wrong. Now, it's not wrong because it's incorrect, but I do think it's wrong because I think what he writes on its own is incomplete. And incomplete information can be as misleading as incorrect, as it is here. And the reason why I say this is because it contradicts Jesus' own comments on divorce that we find in Matthew's Gospel, where he says that unfaithfulness is grounds for divorce, and he says that on two separate occasions. But what I've said right from the start is that Paul is answering specific questions, and he's talking about particular situations and people that he's aware of, people he knows. He's not trying to write the authoritative message on divorce here. It's two sentences. It's not exhaustive. And what is behind this is that during the period that he's writing into, there was quite a low view of marriage. Divorce had become very commonplace, and you could issue a writ of divorce basically on the slightest of pretext, anything you wanted, anything you could think of. So when Paul is writing, he's counterbalancing this. He's trying to bring some balance the other way. He knows what Jesus had said on divorce, and actually, I'm sure he took it as read that the people reading the letter knew that as well. But he's trying to say, do not walk away. Do not separate yourselves from the other, except for the justest of causes. The divorce would be absolutely the last resort. Now, there are times when marriages break down and cannot be restored. But if both parties are willing to allow God to work through them, then healing can be brought about. And sometimes even the reconciliation that Paul mentions here can occur in marriages which had seemingly been lost entirely. And so we come on to the last section of the passage from verse 12. To the rest I say this, I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or the sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? In terms of what I just read there, it's actually quite nicely summed up by Paul in the verse after the one where I'm supposed to finish today, verse 17, where he says, you must accept whatever situation the Lord has put you in and continue on as you were when God first called you. This is my rule for all the churches. I feel like I'm repeating myself quite a lot today, but I cannot stress enough that, again, Paul is speaking against a specific issue here, and to be fair, not just here, probably in the wider early church as well, where individuals are quite understandably looking to leave behind their old lives in their entirety, including their job, their home, their spouse, even their entire family at times. And it seems very strange for us, but for them it must have been so confusing not to feel but to drop everything of their old life must be the only way to fully embrace this new life. Talking about being a new creation, we read, the old has gone, the new has come. So to some people, to stop being everything they had ever been before and just be, as a new creation, something completely different, actually makes some kind of sense. And Paul's words here help to ground those people by saying, no, God has not called you out of your situation. No, he has called to you in your situation. He's called to you within it. Part of what these people were taking into their relationships with God, and I guess the older maybe they were when they came to faith, maybe the truer it was, is that their old lives, their relationships, their habits, their characteristics were all coming in as part of their faith. Now, some of those things would be changed. Some of them would be trimmed away, and some of them would change over time as these people matured in their faith. But God, as a loving God, as more than a loving God, God is love, would not call people out of a loving relationship when they come to him. That would be almost against his character. But then he also calls them to live in peace, and that's finally where Paul is coming from when he says if a non-Christian partner walks away, that their Christian partner is not bound in those circumstances, for God has called them to live in peace. So there we are. That's one of the trickier talks I've had to find my way through. How do we sum all of this up for ourselves when so much of what I talked about this morning is about how these words don't necessarily translate very easily into our own lives? Well, I just have two small things to leave you with. Firstly, whether we're single or not, our marital status can be a barrier if it becomes a wall between you and God in your relationship, if it becomes an issue that holds you back from fully trusting him. We may feel, looking at this, well, I'm married, so clearly I don't have enough time to really commit myself to him as I'd otherwise be able to. Or I'm too stressed and busy worrying about my family to fit him in day to day. Others of us may feel that we have time, but lack support or direction in knowing how to channel that time best. Some of us may be lonely and feel that following God isn't really fulfilling that sense of aloneness that we have. All of those things can become barriers, not because those situations in themselves are barriers, but because we let them be that. We give them the power to be that. There is no wrong status when it comes to following God, to be single, to be married. Situations don't actually matter to God, because that's the stuff that he can handle. That's his bread and butter. What he can't do, or rather what he won't do, is he won't change our hearts. That bit is down to us. And some of us can be quite stubborn, or hard-hearted even, and deliberately keep ourselves from coming closer to God and put up these things almost as an excuse. But most of us, if we do struggle in this area, it's because we do allow these things to grow up in our lives and separate ourselves from him, sometimes without even meaning to, without even wanting to. Well, to each of those people in particular, I really felt God would say to each of us, just give me yourself, and I will not turn you away. Within your situations, whatever that might be, let him take care of the stuff that worries you so much, the things that hold you back, that you feel like are so valid from stopping you from following him more, but that don't really exist when they're set against God and all of his glory, all of his power, and all of his authority over those things. And secondly, and absolutely finally, this passage reads on the surface as being very much about human relationships and interactions. And to an extent, it is. Of course it is. But the thread that runs right from the beginning is of people wanting to know how to live for God. How to find a balance between what needs to stay in the past and be left behind and what needs to come with them as they walk with God. It's a very good question to ask, and probably isn't one that comes to mind for us all that often. When I was praying this week, I had the image come to mind of God as the shepherd who walks ahead of us and gently just nudges us, guides us in the right direction. And I wondered, is now a time for some of us where perhaps he's stopped and turned to us to say, you can't keep travelling holding that. If you want to follow where I'm going next, you can't keep on if you insist on trying to keep hold of this thing or that thing. Or maybe for some of us, all of these things. The Corinthians were suggesting some very odd things to Paul, but at least they were asking questions with the right motivation. At least they were saying, what can we do, practically speaking, to leave behind the parts of our lives that would draw us away from God? And maybe that's a good question to ask ourselves now and over the next week and see where that takes us. Amen.